This week, gold, silver, and shares blasted higher, with the NASDAQ finishing the week at yet another all-time record. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, back here at the Speed of Thought August 24th show. Another two big guest interviews in this season 13, episode 658 edition. Well, after nearly three down months, the precious metals finally registered a solid advance with the traditionally robust holiday season just around the corner and political shenanigans in Washington. Safe haven investments have regained some appeal. So, is the bottom in place, and could this gold stampede have some legs? Joining me with their thoughts, two more big industry insiders. Chris Blasi, president of Neptune Global. He outlines his gold and Bitcoin outlook for 2018. He prefers gold and silver, noting that the cryptocurrency markets just may have gotten a bit too pets.com-like in 2017. He wants to see more of the excesses wrung out of the market and thinks the precious metals are the relative opportunity. Bob Hoy, institutional advisors, also makes a case for a gold rally. He thinks a dollar sell-off could continue amid anti-rate hike comments from at least one of the Fed officials. And we discuss one pie-in-the-sky number from Thomas Lee, top money manager, who's looking for $10 million gold on the backs of the 96 million millennials who don't trust centralized banking. They could actually turn to the crypto market. And we, of course, point out that that's a few dollars away from that stellar forecast. But nevertheless, it's always nice to hear positive comments from sharp folks. And I'm giving away a free crypto pet bronze to the first Alpha Stocks newsletter subscriber. It's a testnet Ethereum value would be well over $1,000. And we'll also be giving at least 10 to 50 free testnet Ethereum with this first subscriber, and then free crypto pets to every other subscriber. And if you go 5 to 10 years, you'll get a top of the line crypto pet plus 100 testnet Ethereum, which we think will gain considerable value over the next few years. And the Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. We'd like to hear your questions and comments, so please jot down or plug it right into your iPhone, Android, or regular phone, 641-715-3900. You can call 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Cancel, delete, and re-record if you like, extension number 514049. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the precious metals sector following lukewarm comments on the domestic economy emanating from the Fed's Jackson Hole meeting, as well as political turmoil in Washington. At Friday's closing bell, the yellow metal added $29, closing well over that 1,200 point at 1,213. Silver picked up 16 cents, within earshot of $15 at $14.79 an ounce, while the XAU precious metal shares picked up $1.76, 11%, closing at $67.68. Black gold picked up $3.50, ending at $68.72. The Bitcoin ETF, GBTC, added 31 cents, 3.5%, finishing at 918. Gold Seek Radio continues to follow the Halo Token project with strong interest. The top story moving the precious metals markets this week, the U.S. dollar came under pressure, sending the metals higher on the heels of a speech at the Jackson Hole, Wyoming meeting from Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. The Fed head noted U.S. rate hikes would likely continue as few signs of an overheating economy were evident, and officials remain vigilant over the potential for inflation, ready to combat it with rate hikes if necessary, noting they'll do whatever it takes if prices get beyond their comfort zone. But St. Louis Fed President James Bullard wanted nothing of it. On Friday, he told CNBC his dovish comments, noting that rates will remain fixed for the time being. Gold held its gains following Bullard's interview, with the biggest one-day gain in 5 months. Turning to geopolitical news, Russia added more gold reserves in July than at any other month this year in anticipation of strong U.S. sanctions. The Russian central bank picked up 26 tons last month, taking its holdings to 2,170 tons, according to a Bloomberg report. $77 billion at the end of the month. The last time the nation bought more gold over a year ago, the central bank's first deputy governor, Dmitry Tulin, made a solid pitch to every global investor for the yellow metal, calling it a 100% guarantee from legal and political risks. You know, I wonder if he's been listening to Gold Seek Radio or reading my Alpha Stocks newsletter. Well, at any rate, Jim Rekords agreed with him, noting that this was a very smart move by the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Bottom line on precious metals, the U.S. dollar pullback did give us some breathing room. While the technical picture looks like capitulation may be in place, and perhaps stronger hands will build a position. Plus, the holiday buying season is heating up, adding solid support for the bullish inverted head and shoulders pattern, similar to that of 2009. So we're looking for a strong rally in gold and silver in the coming months. Turning to the Wall Street Report, nary a cloud appeared over the U.S. equities market, with the tech-laden index recording an all-time record close, 15% higher year-to-date on better-than-expected economic reports and tame comments from Fed officials. The Dow Jones added an impressive 121 points, 0.5% at 25,669, while the S&P 500 picked up 25 at 2874, but it was the NASDAQ composite that really stole the show again, up 130 points, just shy of 8,000, closing at 7945. Well, Jeffrey Hirsch, the editor of the Stock Traders Almanac, found solid stock market growth typically into November during midterm elections, as we have this year. They've resulted in gains of around 4% ever since 1950 on average. So an interesting share in the news included Splunk reported better than expected earnings. It gapped up higher at the open, soaring to 123, up 20%. The data analytics innovator has now generated about 80% in less than 1 year. In addition, Autodesk added 19%. The industrial design software giant had solid quarterly earnings of 19 cents, topping estimates. Big revenues, but perhaps the best bargain, Zscaler, ticker ZS, added over 10% this week, closing at $44, breaking out of a months-long range at least on solid volume. And DocuSign, D-O-C-U, as well as Palo Alto, P-A-N-W, look solid. They were highlighted in a recent Investors Business Daily weekly report of new IPO stocks in the news. Palo Alto, ticker PANW, is a top player in the data network security sector. The Santa Clara, California innovator works on computer network firewalls. U.S. shares bottom line. Well, as we noted in the last report, new highs unfolded with wildly bullish technicals, and the herd is still not fully invested in U.S. shares, according to the 7-indicator greed to fear index. So as long as we remain in the sort of neutral to plus, not overextended, there does seem to be more room for gains in the coming weeks. But the proviso, we don't see too much more political nonsense in Washington, that this is all just smoke and mirrors. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. News that the current administration in the U.S. is displeased with the Federal Reserve. And other interesting topicality, the subject of today's show. It's a pleasure to welcome back Bob Hoy, the editor and chief investment strategist of chartsandmarkets.com, formerly Institutional Advisors.
Chris, good to be with you, and thanks for setting this up.
You're the first person on the speed dial here at the studio we decided to ring up. President has criticized the Fed. CNBC and other news outlets are saying that 4 days ahead of the Jackson Hole meeting, where our current Fed Chairman Jerome Powell will give his big speech. I'd like your take, because so many of our listeners are not big fans of the Federal Reserve.
Right. Trump is not the first president to lean on the Fed. The other thing is, to put the Federal Reserve system in perspective, it was innocently enough described, they figured that the Fed would be able to prevent the financial setbacks that precede recessions. Now, that was a way back in the 19-teens. And if you take the Fed from since it opened its doors in January 1914, there's been 18 recessions. So the theory that the Fed can prevent recessions hasn't been successful over 100 years of testing. So then what has happened, it's been corrupted into funding an experiment in unlimited government. And, of course, that involves easy credit and the generation of financial bubbles, all of which help to serve to fund the state. just the mere practice of currency depreciation is in a way funding the state. So the whole of the Fed is evil. But anyways, with Trump criticizing the Fed and leaning on the Fed, hoping for lower interest rates, I think this is the public man talking. It's like it's the president rather than Trump, because if it was a previous president, he'd be saying the same thing. And the issue here is, of course, this, the establishment doesn't like rising interest rates. They seem to think it causes bad things, but if you take a look 100 years of business history or so, and you look at the free market rates, you know, like market rates of interest, like the T-bill rate, the short end, interest rates go up in a boom. So as long as interest rates are going up, it confirms the boom is on. So that's a good thing. The danger is when the T-bill rate turns down. So I'm disappointed in Trump saying that, but as I said, it's probably the public man, his desk, the office, whatever, speaking, and it's talking orthodox stuff that they don't like rates going up. And the damage that the Federal Reserve has done in 100 years by artificially lowering interest rates is horrendous. It effectively, that was the pitch on what they were trying to do. But the end result was it depreciated the dollar down to about only 93% of its purchasing power of 1914. So the short data rate will go up until the boom is over. Then it goes down. And then following that by a couple of months, the Federal Reserve would make a big noise and cut Fed funds rate, or as it used to be called, the discount rate. We had, Chris, a lot of fun with this in 2007 when in the summer you had credit spreads widening and the yield curve steepening, stuff like that, which then the establishment became a little nervous. And then in order to comfort themselves, they said, oh, the Fed will cut rates. And gosh, I got a nice little piece on that. I can't remember who it is at the moment. I think it was September the 7th. 2007. So the Fed was going to do the perfectly timed interest rate cut and all would be well. Now, obviously, that guy was in theory land and had never looked at the history of interest rates. And the history is simple. Short rates go up in a boom and they go down in a bust. So then if you take the senior central bank, now the bank, the Federal Reserve, and formerly the Bank of England in London. So you can get really good numbers back to the 1873 bubble. So in that crash, the Bank of England's discount rate, I think it went up by about 700 basis points. And then in 1929, the Federal Reserve discount rate went up, I think, 450 basis points. And then following 2007, the interest rate fell from 5 to, you know, 0. So same sort of thing. But in that period of time, the lesson that just looking at history tells you is that not just that interest rates go up in a boom and down in a bust, but the harder the bust, the faster interest rates fall. So, Chris, this is going to be fascinating over the next couple of months because they're getting upset about the rising short rates. But on the other hand, I just wrote down a couple of headlines whereby China, which had been lending money generously to emerging countries, taking a look, I guess, $30 billion they lent to Venezuela. And they haven't got a hope getting that back. So they're now going to become a little cautious on this. And this is the one thing that the Austrian School of Economics, which did a reasonably practical study on interest rates and credit and money. The one thing they point out is that at a boom, you don't have to have the bankers call the loans to get the contraction. All they have to do is get a little nervous and stop making them. So I've got two headlines in the last 2 days that I will use to show that they're beginning to stop making loans, and that's all you need. Yeah, I'm disappointed in Trump leaning on the Fed, but I think he's a more practical businessman, and his businessman side, I don't think, would go along with that. The other thing that was interesting this week is the announcement that the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is going to be selling some crude oil, which makes sense to me. And actually, we've been calling on for this one since May, when crude was 72. Eventually went to, 76? But when it was 72, I thought, Trump will sell from that petroleum reserve because it makes so much sense. You know, U.S. has now huge and growing reserves of petroleum stuff, you know, from natural gas to heavy crude. So, why keep that? So it's a good thing to sell it. And also it'll help his bargaining with Putin and Russia. If he can, Russia's got to be really scared of falling energy prices, because really all it is one big huge service station, as some wit described a few years ago. There's a line that about Russian oil is being delivered to the east coast of the United States because the people in New England states don't like pipelines, whereby you've got good reserves in the western provinces in Canada. And the Ontario and Quebec people won't allow a pipeline from the west to the east, and they would sooner continue to get their oil on the Atlantic provinces from Venezuela, from Russia, and stuff like that.
I'd like to return the focus just briefly to our president's intention. He made it clear that he's not happy at all with the strong dollar. Quite a rally in the past several months, and actually the highest at last check of 14-month high last week. Now, he's not happy with the strong dollar because, as you know, I'm sure his key economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, has made it clear that this hurts exports. Whatever you think about this individual, he wants America to succeed economically, and he wants to see stronger exports. Obviously, a strong dollar makes our goods, at least on a relative basis, more expensive. Now, the thing I think he's missing is the strong dollar makes U.S. equities more appealing, the dividends, because it pays out in a stronger currency. And I think this is one of the reasons why you've seen the Dow, in particular in the blue chips, which tend to pay a higher dividend yield, do so remarkably well, even against this runaway NASDAQ market we had in the last few months. Okay, but back on point. So he's saying that this gives China, let's call it an artificial advantage, and he also notes that the Europeans, he feels, were manipulating the euro to improve their exports to our disadvantage. Now, whether or not we want to get into all the minutiae there, I'll leave that up to you. But I wanted to say that it all comes together on Monday, where he said he's not thrilled at all with the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell for raising rates and the manipulation from our key trading partners. And I think that if you bring this all together, it shows for the first time that I can recall in many years, at least 10 years, we have a standing president who is not afraid to take on the most invincible and powerful institution in the world. And I would argue that's the Federal Reserve. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. He is, on wanting to talk the dollar down, that again is his office speaking. If, as a businessman, he would know that economists messing around with purchasing power of currency is just theoretical nonsense. But the market forces will dominate, and in a post-bubble contraction, all of them, going away back for 300 years, the feature has been that the senior currency during the contraction becomes chronically strong against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. I invented that line a long time ago. And the when the U.S. dollar index based or sold off hard early in the year down to 88, oversold, then what we needed was a few months of building a base, which it did. And then we've found that important bottoms like 2008 and 2014, that was the pattern. Oversold, build a base, and then it completed when the DX rose above the 20-week exponential moving average, and that was on April 23rd. So the dollar index is, again, got overbought when on the first rush to almost 96. And then it's building a base over the last few weeks for what we figure can, you know, can get up to 101 or 102 on the chart. Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the last high was. I think it was 103. But at any rate, the dollar index is behaving the way we figured it would once it got the breakout. And we also have the history that in a post-bubble contraction, the senior currency becomes strong. And, Chris, I think the mechanism behind that is that during the financial boom, serious money ends up reaching for yield and buying a whole lot of junk, and that includes many junk companies outside the U.S. and far too many countries outside the U.S., and that's due and payable, most of it, in U.S. dollars into New York. So, in effect, the great bubble of expanding debt, then once the contraction starts, just servicing that debt becomes an immense short position. So on the longer term, the dollar is likely to get uncomfortably high. So this is where, unfortunately for Trump and him trying to talk the dollar down, I believe that's his office speaking, not himself. And if it was himself thinking as a businessman, you don't want to have the Fed doing anything, just and neither cheapening or pushing the dollar up, but market forces will push the dollar up. And then the other thing is that the Fed shouldn't be cheapening or pushing interest rates up or down. That should be strictly in the market hands anyways, which it is. As I said, once the T-bill rate rolls over and heads down, the Fed will then have no alternative but to lower the Fed funds rate, which was the case in 1929. The T-bill rate went up until, I think it was May, and then June had turned down, and then with the contraction becoming so visible at the end of September of 1929, then I think it was October when the Fed lowered its discount rate, and then at the T-bill rate effectively went down to zero in the early 1930s. So there's none of what's going on now is new. And our view, as I've said, is that we have accomplished, the markets have accomplished a fabulous bubble. And sure, you've had, that was with the highs in December, January, and the NASDAQ has gone on to new highs, the Russell has, small caps, but the crux of this is how the market behaves over the next 6 to 8 weeks. Credit spreads have begun to turn, and we had the first, what we call the first breakout. That was in June, and then now you've had the correction against that. But in the last week, the spreads have started widening again. So what we're looking for is the second breakout in widening. And in 2007, that occurred in late August, early September. And as you recall, the S&P had its peak in the middle of October of 2007. So I would say, Chris, that what we look at in what we called them our friends of the bull market back in February, and that hit, we said that the industrial commodities would recover until around May, which they did. And base metals had a good rally. Lumber went hysterical on the upside. And then after May, these would head down and would no longer be friends of the bull market. And yeah, the lumber got killed. Base metals had a pretty good hit. But these things are having a little rally now because they got oversold last week that we're getting a rally. So then the other two items are the credit spreads and the yield curve. And they were expected to be friendly until about May. Well, on the yield curve, which everybody's talking about, that it's flattening and you know, may become inverted. On the curve from the 5s to the 30s is no longer on trend, but it hasn't reversed trend, so it's no longer friendly. So, Chris, our friends of the bull market are no longer friendly in aggregate. So we just watch how this plays out over the next 6 to 8 weeks.
You know, I think I have a competing view, though. It makes me cringe when I hear people talk about the end of this bull market. I have had some of the sharpest minds, well-known folks in the world on this show. I'm humbled to have them here, obviously, and this little dog and pony act. But nevertheless, what I've heard over the years is the only folks who have been consistently right have sort of looked away from the fundamentals and just said, you know, we are extremely overvalued, especially the S&P 500, obviously. Valuations are extended and then extended again, maybe 3 standard deviations from the norm. It's like old turkey from Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, Edwin Lefebvre. You know, after all, it is a bull market. This is one of those tides that can keep going and going. It reminds me of the gold bull market that started arguably around the year 2000-2001. Lasted 12 consistent years, never a down year. Charlie Lee is a very successful fund manager, and he brought up a fresh perspective. It's a demographic that's stunning, and I think very few of our listeners will know this, and that is that millennials comprise 96 million Americans. So essentially, 1 in 3 people today was born around or after the year 2000. Now, this is a very unique group of people, just as were the X generation, which I fall into. They saw their parents lose their homes in 2008-2009. They have no trust whatsoever for the traditional financial banking system or traditional financial institutions, and they only are interested in things that are outside that system, such as the cryptocurrencies and our homes that are mostly paid for or financed without the traditional methods. These folks are expected now to continue investing not in the traditional stocks and bonds and real estate and whatnot. They are the highest purchasers of recreational vehicles. They're actually living in recreational vehicles since the 1950s and 60s. This is a new trend. Charlie Lee suggests that they will continue to invest, and they've only just started, primarily in decentralized and transparent markets, of course, the cryptocurrencies. He's predicting Bitcoin at a level that's so high, so far beyond anything anyone has ever announced, even in the peak of 2017, predicting something much further beyond 250,000, which is what we're calling for here by 2022. He claims that it will be primarily in the United States driven by the millennials, and then outside the United States, it will be driven by the need for financial services in third world and emerging economies where they simply just don't have access, and they haven't had access to these key services and financing and banking. And might that be the peak in U.S. equities and housing and lead to a resurgence in the cryptocurrency market?
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I appreciate Lee's work on the demographics, but we should look back to the 2000 bubble. That was part of that story was the demographics, is that the baby boomers were retiring, and every minute there was 10,000 baby boomers retiring, and they're all going to have a pension fund full of equities. Now, on that bubble, of which, as you know, I've done a lot of work, are beginning in January 2000, we had our bubble indicators, a whole bunch of stuff, and with the credit spreads and the yield curve, we counted out that probably the credit markets would begin to change in March of 2000. And what happened was is that as we got into March, the spreads and the curve and the bubble all blew out at the same time. But later on in 2000, you had the really serious change in the credit markets that then pushed off the bear market. So on the 2000 bubble, we had in January, we had a target for a possible high in March. On the 2007 bubble, our work on the credit markets, spreads and the curve, that year expected it to be positive into May or June, and that's when the reversals came in, and you recall that Bear Stearns began to announce their problems about in early June of 2007, and then the rest was, as I said, a little while ago, the second breakout in widening credit spreads in late August that did the whole market in. And then now recently on the bubble in the Bitcoin, you recall that our October 4th edition said that everything was going to get bubbled, and even threw in that even the Dow Jones would get bubbled. And then the next part of that October 4th study was that there'd been so many spectacular speculations in the past that had concluded in the December-January window. The Nikkei bubble, last trading day of 89, and then gold and silver, I think it was January 20th of 1980. And we even found peak in the Dow Jones turn of the year one in 1893. So our target on that bubble was that it would likely conclude in December, January, and it did. So the work that we've done, Chris, has been we try to get things, the big, big ones, some months before they happen, and then look for the technical excesses as they happen. Now, for example, on the Bitcoin stock itself, on December 19th, my colleague Ross and his technical staff got a sequential sell on the 19th, and there hadn't been that signal in 2 years, so we concluded that the correction would be the greatest in 2 years, and it was. So now the rest of it is, in the hands of the credit market, and they have been friendly until recent, and they're not unfriendly. It's just they're no longer friendly. There's in the spread and in curves, there is not the distinctive trend change yet. But the way I'm looking at it now and writing for this week's piece is that we will be monitoring for the change, and this method of having the history plus the a very good technical analysis has served us well before. So, but on the demographics thing about the millennials, I should mention that when the demographic story was really broadcast, which was in 2000 bubble, and then after it went bad, Prechter at the Elliott Wave guys, he did do a thorough study of 1929 and that contraction, and he pointed out with a lot of evidence and charts and stuff, is that a market bust like that one pushes and changes the demographics. People stopped having babies, for example, stuff like that. So it's one of those things, Chris, that when you go and start working on demographics, it's best to consider that if you are in a fabulous bubble, the break in the bubble may change the demographics. So I'd be wary of demographic studies.
You obviously can't base your bullish analysis just on any single indicator, whether it be fundamental or technical, but a couple of interesting anecdotes. Firstly, anyone who's talking about cryptos, even the top guys like, you know, Novogratz, Lee, and so many others, always start off with, look, I believe cryptos could just as easily go to zip as they could to infinity, that we're in a big bubble here. However, there are some key things I'd like for people to keep in mind. The institutions have only just started to get invested in the cryptocurrencies. Currently, we estimate only 2-3% of Americans have any exposure at all to Bitcoin, and that might just be fractional. And if you look at the adoption curve on Bitcoin, we are truly at the genesis. I mean, this is just the nascent market that we see. So there has been very little adoption in the United States or outside the United States. Another key point that I'd add in here, and in any new market, similar to email or AOL or something like that, it's very easy to assume that because you've seen a really big blow-off peak and a 20-fold move from the beginning of 2017 to the end, we saw a 20x. That is very rare in almost any market. However, we've seen similar moves in Bitcoin before, and it held its ground and then continued to move higher. What I think is happening here, for the first time in history, we have a market that skipped Wall Street altogether. It really was a grassroots Main Street revolution. Again, for the first time, let's say since the Dutch tulip mania in Amsterdam, or earlier if you like, it is the hoi polloi, the masses in total control of this revolution, and now Wall Street, crony capitalistic system, they are scrambling. You know, we find out that Goldman, JP Morgan, and many others are just now setting up trading desks in the cryptocurrency market. Many of the hedge funds and institutions are as well. So as we see this revolution unfold and people start to adopt, this is a much more transparent and it's a much more private way. The real key takeaway here is we could see a resurgence, I think. If we can hold 5,700 on Bitcoin, which may not hold, we may still have to retest, it could give us a springboard that sets this market back up. We're seeing a washout now, similar, I think, to the precious metals. Into 2022, we see favorable things ahead. And so if you want to forget all the fundamental and the technical analysis, I invite listeners to argue with me. Keep sending the emails. You're challenging all of us here to think outside the box, and we appreciate that. Call into our hotline and leave your Q&A. The cryptocurrency market has unique aspects to it that have never really emerged, but there's one that stands out as a must-hear attribute. The cryptos are the most inversely correlated, or non-correlated asset class today. In fact, they're becoming even more inversely correlated week by week, month by month. This is one of the first times in decades, maybe even longer, that any such thing has emerged. Add to that fact that it's only, what is it, a $300 billion market? That's not even peanuts for large institutions to dip their toe in the water. There is nothing that makes deep-pocketed money managers and financial institutions and pension fund managers salivate more than an asset class that deeply lowers the beta of stocks and bonds and the traditional real estate. An off-the-chart alpha. If you just take 1% of your fund or your pension funds and you invest it in cryptos, you're going to get a 10 or 20% offset in your overall portfolio beta. So you double or treble the expected return on the upside of your portfolio. That point alone means that every one of our listeners should have some exposure to cryptos. Your thoughts?
Your arguments are sound. You've put a lot of evidence together to build a case. But what you're talking about is the cryptocurrency that is a finite item, and you're playing the shortage and the potential for that there's too many buyers and not enough product. My view on the crypto and this side is that it has the ability to provide a currency that is relatively constant purchasing power. And for that currency, it also has to be very liquid. So the Bitcoin at the moment, you are playing the fact that it is not liquid. The utility to society will be at some time to where a variation will provide a very liquid currency for transactions and whatnot. It may end up being related to gold. I don't know, but with this popular uprising going on where people are attempting to get direct control of their government again, as in government by the people, I believe it'll be successful. But the other part of that is in order to protect themselves from the bandits in government, it will have to have a currency that the intellectuals, the economists, the politicians, and the bureaucrats can't mess up to their advantage. So this is where somewhere, Chris, there will be a crypto item that is highly liquid and will provide a currency of relatively constant purchasing power, and I'm really looking forward to it.
We've all heard the emperor has no clothes, we remember. It's as though there were a Bengal or Siberian tiger, and the emperor just did not believe that a tiger could exist. Our central bankers are the emperors. They are convinced, oh, this cryptocurrency nonsense, it's just electronic digital money. These people are deluded with themselves. It's a bunch of kids in their mama's basement driving Lambos in their sandals and Crocs. There really is a Bengal tiger loose in the currency market. There are Turing complete currencies out there that aren't just currencies. For instance, Ethereum. It's not just a currency. As I said, it's Turing complete, which is just fancy lingo or jargon to indicate that it is a highly programmable money. It's a contract of exceptional power that people are only now beginning, even the sharpest minds are beginning to recognize. There's $100 billion, maybe more, market in crypto assets, which started with crypto kitties. Now I'm on to crypto pets, and we're distributing those to our listeners here today, which we think it's going to be much bigger than crypto kitties. We're giving them away for new subscribers. When you bring this together, you can print them up out of thin air. There's tens of thousands of them. Why don't you think that's diluting the market? And I point out, well, it may dilute it to some extent, but each currency has its own unique qualities. It's like trying to compare Google with Amazon, Amazon with Yahoo, Yahoo with Netflix. You know, it's a non sequitur. It does not follow. So I would just like to leave that with listeners that while I agree with you, Bob Hoy, that as a currency, this is the genesis of a currency, and it's really a weak currency. But if you look at the entire, let's call it domain or crypto space, as they call it, I want to say $20 to $60 trillion market that is only right now around $300 billion. If you're trying to get rich quick, it's way too volatile of a market. But if you're a smart, long-term investor and you want to take 1 to 3%, maybe 5% at the most, and you want to rotate out of some equities profits or bond profits into something that's going to massively lower your overall beta while supercharging the alpha on the upside, just think of it from a scientific perspective. Throw some darts to the top guys. As it continues to drop, you can get it at fire sale prices. Parting thoughts on the precious metals. Do you think if the U.S. dollar tops here that it might give us a buying opportunity?
Last week, on the gold and the gold stocks like GDXG, we got a downside on them, a sequential buy. We also got that on the base metals like copper. So we can get a rally for a few weeks. And also, a week and a half ago on crude oil, we noted that the trading pattern was now into vulnerable, and it sort of got hit a bit. So base metals and the precious metals can rally for a few weeks, but we keep in mind that copper can have a seasonal low in October, crude oil seasonal low in December, January, and lumber, which was a fabulous bubble on that one, a low in October as well. So once we're past middle of September, industrial commodities can head south, and it won't be good for the stock market. So there we are.
You do feel that every portfolio should at least be thinking about rotating into some discounted precious metals if you've had some stellar gains.
That would be for a trade, a brief trade from a week and a half ago until into September. Then after that, watch out.
You're not a believer, then, that the Fed may stop raising rates next year as the EU and China pull back their QE operations, which could really nosedive the greenback?
Yeah, the Fed is going to get beat up by market forces yet again. We're in a bubble. It looks like the Fed is in control. And then in the contraction, the power shifts. I'm easy to get in touch with. It's just Google BobHoy.com. You know, the www.bobhoy, BobHoye.com. That gets us into the whole system.
And chartsandmarkets.com.
Yep.
Have the best day, Bob.
Okay, thanks. Bye, Chris.
So glad you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's featured guest, Chris Blasi from NeptuneGlobal.com. Chris Blasi, president of Neptune Global, founder of the PMC Ounce Rate Index, also a cryptocurrency analyst. Welcome back, Chris Blasi.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be on again.
It's great to have you back, and it's probably a good time because there's been a lot of volatility in our favorite precious metals sector, and we know you keep your finger on the pulse. Give us an idea of your take, please, on whether or not we could get that bounce in gold and silver.
You know, obviously over the last 2 weeks, we've had a lot of volatility more to the downside. You know, preceding that, we had a long protracted period of the precious metals trading sideways. And that, you know, that's the worst environment. It does not inspire investors, either those who feel confirmation when metals are moving up or those looking for a good buying opportunity when they pull back. Now, actually, in the last 2 weeks, we were very busy. There were some folks selling, but there are actually some very large investors expanding their positions. So, you know, they're firmly convinced that precious metals and gold have a very positive future, and they just saw it as an opportunity. Now, our sense is this, that the fall is going to be a time that a lot of the fundamentals and a lot of the pending events that we're looking for to be a boost and a catalyst to you know, help propel the precious metals prices are going to take place. They generally don't happen in the summer. And that's the nature of all markets, even the stock market, right? The fall is when you see the action. And, you know, people always think it's October. It actually tends to be September. So we think with the midterms coming up, there's going to be a confluence of revelations made, you know, that are going to be very politically oriented. They're going to be very destabilizing and very going to shake the faith in markets. And it's going to be positive for the precious metals.
Does the dollar come into play here? Are you factoring in the dollar strength and continued rate hikes at the Fed?
What you're going to see is we've known that the dollar has rallied recently, which is, you know, one of the things that, you know, people point out is putting pressure, downward pressure on the metals. I think the dollar is going to reverse course come the fall. I think, you know, a lot of things are going to fall into place, whether it's the dollar pulling back, the Fed, you know, having to change their tone and their language and, you know, their outlook. And I think there's other things that are going to be actually more geopolitical and domestically political that are going to help destabilize things, which will be the catalyst for knocking the dollar down, putting some of the things into place that are going to help propel the precious metals.
Very good. We also know that you keep an eye on platinum and related metals as well. Any thoughts there?
Yes. Something that I think is extremely interesting is that the tightness for platinum and palladium. Still the delivery times on for us, you know, as a dealer, tier one dealer, you know, we're getting the gold and silver we need. And, you know, delivery schedules are a little bit elongated because despite all the selling, there isn't a big pile of gold and silver readily available. But it's even that tightness is much more pronounced than platinum and palladium. So, you know, again, that's pointing to when things finally start to fall into place that there's a tremendous amount of pent-up, you know, price drivers for platinum and palladium. So, you know, it's real. It's actually been going on with platinum and palladium for several months now. So, you know, the platinum and palladium price has been knocked down. You know, you were kind enough to mention the PMC ounce, the precious metals composite, which there's the PMC index, which is looking at the overall performance of the precious metals market by a weighted allocation of gold, silver, platinum, palladium. But there's also the investable product, the PMC ounce, and it has platinum and palladium in it. So we always think that for a person to establish a position also in platinum palladium, it's much more logical with the PMC ounce because it's logically weighted. You know, a person shouldn't be greedy and just say, well, I heard, you know, some good news for platinum palladium and just pile and go all in them. You know, I would still say you still have a nice measured, balanced portfolio across the precious metals, and the PMC ounce provides that. And we do see a lot of investors coming in because they like the having that exposure to the platinum palladium, and they see and they sense a lot of potential for the platinum palladium in the next leg up.
And moving on to the cryptocurrencies, you also keep an eye on the crypto space, trying to hammer out a bottom in Bitcoin. Ethereum has suffered 70% losses at least from its peak price from just 6 to 8 months ago. Do you believe, though, in the long-term promise by crypto adherents that we have an encryption and transparency and decentralization theme that will be central to the modern economy over the next 10 years? And how might investors start to position themselves with these discounted prices?
So 3-4 months ago, when we were the ones that, we didn't say we didn't denigrate them, but we cast a little doubt that people did not understand what they were getting involved in. They were also conflating a cryptocurrency with blockchain, right? Blockchain has not cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency just uses the blockchain, you know. So there was so much disinformation, and of course there was so much, you know, we were full of blind enthusiasm, and we were vilified, right, for even casting a doubt that the cryptocurrencies wouldn't go to a million as some people were forecasting, or Bitcoin would go to a million. So, of course, a lot of questions have come up about cryptocurrencies. A lot of those questions still have not been answered, and now the cryptocurrencies have fallen to a level, as things get sorted out. I don't believe it's imminent that going up. I also think there's a big difference between using blockchain technology and processes for businesses. That doesn't necessarily mean blockchain being deployed and embraced by businesses to use as part of their processes. That doesn't automatically make cryptocurrencies go up. They're two completely different things. I also think digital money, or like cryptocurrencies, will be co-opted by governments in the future. And to me, that's not a good thing. So as far as, is this a good time to position in the cryptocurrencies? I think there's still so many questions out there. I don't see this as the same thing as, you know, gold pulling back and providing a buying opportunity. That I do not see as the same situation for the cryptocurrencies.
So you're not as enthusiastic on their prospects right now relative to the precious metals?
No, I'm not. It's even an item. It's even a product that's trying to find out what it is. Is it a currency or is it just a speculative investment, right? I mean, if it's going to function as a currency, right, it wouldn't have the volatility that it has. You can't run a business, you know, accepting a form of payment that you can turn around right after you receive it. And then next thing you know, it's lost 5-10% of it. If you look at the euphoria and the mania, you know, prior to the cryptos pulling back, you know, no one would want to talk about some, you know, basic things about it, right? How safe are they with the exchanges being raided and your Bitcoins being stolen and no way to recover them? I mean, these are really serious questions. And everyone just wanted to discount it because they were excited they're onto something that would make them a lot of money quick. It's no different than the dot-com mania, and I worked in big tech at the time. You know, all because the dot-com mania and companies like Pets.com, which went to oblivion because they were ridiculous business plans, that did not mean the Internet wasn't viable and growing. I think people forget the Internet is bigger than it was in 2000, but you still had the tech wreck for all dot-com companies that were just being bid up in price because they said they were moving their business to the Internet, but it was still a poor or ridiculous business plan. Now, there's a commonality. You know, blockchain is not cryptocurrency, and digital currency will come about, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, and it's a work in progress, and it's going to take time before I believe there's truly viable, relatively safe, you know, trustworthy digital currency that has a degree of stability that can function as a currency and not just a speculative trade.
No, I think the dot-com parallel with the cryptos, especially up until, you know, December of 2017 last year, it really holds water. I mean, I was there, cut my teeth in the late 90s, early 2000s as well. The IPO craze, there's just too many similarities. The market price behavior was maybe, you could argue, even more pronounced on many levels. And while I can easily make the fundamental case for institutional money, supposedly in the next 6 to 8 months flowing in like we've never seen into Bitcoin and their related currencies, that adoption rates are still relatively low in the maybe the single digit level, and most markets aren't mature until you get much higher, 20 to 50% or more. Markets discount these activities sometimes 6 months to 12 months ahead, which means all of those could be, as any, I think, wise student of the market, especially an active trader, knows, you know, the markets are forward-looking, and they've likely already anticipated much of the potential gains that others are now calling for could be, as they say, baked into the cake. You know, you have your solid precious metals core, your diversified portfolio, and maybe a modicum of the cryptos, maybe 1 to 3%, 5%, so that if the trend continues, you can participate, but you don't have oversized exposure.
Sure. Actually, I'm going to go back to a parallel, right? So I think people can draw a parallel. There's another parallel to the dot-com, meaning I believe that digital currency will be coming about and will be a big part of the marketplace. Now, the timing, whether it's 6 months, a year, 2 years, I don't know. But there's another part to it. It's just, again, let's use the analogy of the dot-com mania and the Internet. The Internet thrived, but in 2000, when a lot of the dot-com stocks started collapsing, it doesn't mean all because the Internet was going to be have the success it had 18 years later that any of those companies would be viable investment. Meaning, it doesn't mean that the cryptocurrencies that are out there right now will necessarily be viable, even though digital currency may be, but it may not be the ones that are available right now. So that's why there's a degree of risk, and that's why, like the old adage, are you trying to catch a falling knife?
Keep in mind, the first mover advantage is, I think, a little more unique than in the dot-com space. Ethereum, maybe 5-10 years from now, may not be the number two crypto asset. I think you have to be careful drawing too close a parallel between, let's say, pets.com and Ethereum or Bitcoin, or even Facebook and MySpace, which is now the classic Harvard Business School case, if you will. The coders, the founders, the developers, and then the infrastructure that it requires. For instance, Bitcoin is probably the better example. Infrastructure and developers, probably the best development team in the world, as well as Ethereum. Maybe a little narrow focus to think that that talent, that pool of talent, and that, let's call it, technological base would suddenly shift over to maybe Stellar or Tezos, any of the other competing blockchains. That's not to say that Bitcoin and Ethereum will remain, you know, the Amazon.com and the Google of the future.
I guess I'm looking at it from a different perspective, right? I'm looking at it as an industry. I'm looking at it as, when a lot of people were enamored by Bitcoin, they didn't understand it, right? They used terms like distributed ledger and all that, but didn't understand what that means. There was also, if you recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there was this believing that, you know, the Bitcoin was this own unique thing that was free of any of the risk in anything that is kind of a man-made, like a fiat currency. At the end of the day, there's still coders and developers, and it still has to be upgraded. So it kind of takes the veneer off that it does, there is software behind it. There is a lot of parallels to existing things and with the associated risk. It doesn't mean they're not going to be viable. But one thing, you know, it is good for an investor to understand what they're getting into, right? I mean, a guy like Buffett, everyone likes to quote Warren Buffett, and what does he always say? He goes, he never buys into an industry he doesn't understand. That's why he says he likes kind of basic things like railroads and insurance companies. If they really don't understand the technology behind it, and I'm not going to ever believe that there's zero risk in anything that requires coders and all that, or, you know, they're not vulnerable, that these coders are so superior that they can develop product using basically software that is completely bulletproof. It just doesn't happen. My point is, if a potential retail smaller investor doesn't understand, then when they're picking out, they're kind of, you know, there are 300 plus, right, cryptocurrencies out there, and if they're looking at some of the other ones, then they're really just throwing darts against the wall. And I understand what you say that, you know, Bitcoin would probably be around, even though it may not be the stellar one. Yeah, I still think there's a degree of you're just trying to catch a falling knife at this stage. And so that's why I'm not as, you know, I guess as supportive of that it needs to be part of a portfolio. But, you know, that's just a personal feeling. I just feel that an individual should at least understand the basics of what they're getting invested in. And if it's really completely foreign to them and they really don't understand, you know, why an investment is going to be viable, except that this is probably the future. I don't know what it is really, but I'm still going to go into it. You know, that's just not something I get behind really enthusiastically. But for someone who's a little more knowledgeable like yourself, right, with a background and understanding, you know, to me, I'm sure you could feel much more comfortable and it would make more sense.
Well, you know, that really is the challenge, isn't it? When you're dealing with any sector that is so unique and obviously so novel, there's very little track record. Of course, venture capitalists, folks who take risks and who speculate on new ventures, they like to see some type of track record. I think we could sit here all day and pontificate on either side of the ledger. For every pro, there does seem to be a negative. Bitcoin is only now, as I said, becoming adopted, institutions just getting interested, trading desks opening up on the likes of the top bankers, including JP Morgan, Goldman, etc. But in the final analysis, catching the proverbial dagger requires a certain type of trading mentality that most people are not, you know, well equipped to manage. So on a forward basis, would you then advocate building, as prices reached more reasonable floors, a small holding? Or do you think it's still just too soon? In other words, are you looking for a particular capitulation moment before issuing a buy again on the cryptos?
I just want to see the industry mature more. I'm not looking at it as a price target, and I'm talking about what I would feel is for the typical individual investor who really is not in a position like a institutional investor such that maybe has a certain amount of funds that they say, look, you know, we go into a lot of high-risk things, certain things go to zero, and certain things we knock the cover off the ball, and that when they net it all out, they do quite well. I mean, that generally isn't a good strategy for an individual. I don't think that if a little bit of time passes and we see a little more, like I said, maturity, and we see a little more, you know, when it comes to things are always going to be regulated, and we get more definitive decisions by things like the SEC and such, about how the cryptos are going to be handled or regulated, I don't feel like a little bit of waiting time is going to put a retail investor behind the eight ball. So still very volatile right now, probably still, you know, it could take off from here, but it could also go down somewhat. And if it was to start to climb and it's climbing on what appears to be, you know, solid fundamentals, I think it's okay if, you know, an individual maybe misses out on a couple hundred points, 1,000, 2,000 points of Bitcoin. I think once it proves itself, then it would have a long run, and maybe missing out on just the first couple steps isn't so detrimental.
Well, you know, as a solid believer in the blockchain phenomenon and, of course, decentralization, I'd say, firstly, for folks who have a longer-term focus, if you're interested in Bitcoin and you don't want to try to be a bottom fisher, as they call it, you know, maybe wait for one of those recent swing highs to be eclipsed, 8,500 or 10,000, and see if price stabilizes and then, you know, swing for the previous former all-time record of 20,000. Those might be interesting points to start to build a portfolio. But another little caveat in here, as exciting as 2017 was in the ICO arena, there really wasn't the due diligence that we would traditionally see in investment banking firms. Back in 1998 through the year 2000, people really got excited about the initial public offerings that were essentially managed or brought public by the big names. Okay, so it was Goldman and Morgan. When you saw those names on the prospectus, you knew that this was probably going to be a really interesting IPO. And we didn't have that type of oversight in hundreds of these companies that are now trading somewhat actively on the crypto exchanges. So wouldn't you agree that should be a big red flag for anyone except for the day trader and the speculator?
Well, sure. I mean, it's an opaque industry, right? It's a very opaque industry. There's other things like, you know, even the fact that the exchanges, right, where a Bitcoin, right, would be stolen, you know, there's no way of recovering your money, right? It's just gone, right? I mean, it's unlike, you know, it's still, at least if you're, you know, you're in a bank or your broker's account and someone pilfers your account, you know, and it's not your fault, you're going to be reimbursed and made whole. And, you know, these are basic protections that an individual expects, you know, in a mature institutional market where there's at least some degree of rule of law. You know, we know with the Wild West, right, and everything was opaque, everything was a mystery. That's generally not a healthy environment for an individual. Again, it doesn't mean that it's not going to mature and get to a place that's a little more, I guess, appropriate for an individual to be parking their hard-earned money. But yes, it was a Wild West more than it was in the dot-com bust. In some respects, it was easier to understand what the internet was than a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, what exactly blockchain is and what exactly Bitcoin is. And again, there's this conflating of blockchain with digital currency, right? One just uses the other, but they're not the same thing, right? So if blockchain is going to be a widely deployed technology, which it is going to be, no doubt about it, it doesn't mean everything that uses blockchain necessarily is going to be successful.
So many times we seem to see the comparison of, let's say, Ethereum as, you know, digital silver and Bitcoin as digital gold, but it's really not a fair parallel because obviously Ethereum is programmable money. It should not be even construed, I think, as money at all. It's just a contract system, and many of the contracts have extremely unique characteristics. For instance, you know, the Ethereum request comment, or ERC 721, I believe, is the currency asset contract, which obviously facilitates dApps such as CryptoKitties and the other assets, you know, we believe will be a $100 billion market at the very least in the next 5 to 10 years. So trying to compare that with the more digital gold-like store of value, throwing darts at them without understanding the subtle nuances might be speculative at best. All right. Would you give advice to our listeners who still have some of that Bitcoin euphoria, that maybe these calls for $250,000, $2 million, even $10 million recently, we really need to be careful?
Those are some pretty aggressive numbers. Generally, that on its own should scare somebody. If it's true, I'll go back to what I said before. If it truly is going to go to $250,000, right? I'm just using this as an example. I don't believe this is happening, and I'm not recommending anything. But I'll go back to when I said, would it really hurt an investor to wait a little bit and see some maturity and some more fundamental proof that it's viable and this not, you know, a speculative thing that you'll go into and get wiped out the next day? Meaning if you're going to $250,000 and it's roughly 6,000 now, getting into it at $20,000 on the way to $250,000 would hardly be detrimental, right? A couple thousand dollars just to see some proof, see some maturity, see some, you know, stability, and it becomes a little less opaque, is probably worth a little bit of a wait.
It might be worth addressing one of the characteristics, though, that makes the crypto domain unique, the idea that there really aren't a lot of alternatives that are liquid and easily digitally transferred. I mean, obviously, we're big proponents of gold at Goldsea. Even silver, we think, is still a viable money and currency and will be probably again someday. Very difficult to cross borders, to travel around the world. We were talking with Tim Draper, Silicon Valley Bitcoin enthusiast, talked about a recent transaction involving, I think it was close to $19 million via Bitcoin. Total cost was $1.70 on the transaction. This was to an entirely different continent. It all occurred within, I believe it was less than an hour, and they then compared it with the cost in the neighborhood of $10,000 if they'd used the traditional bank wiring and could have required a week for confirmation. So, I mean, there really are some unique characteristics. Do you worry, though, that the traditional financial institutions might usurp that and establish their own competing crypto?
I've always felt that was exactly what would happen, that it will be taken over by them. It will become the law that you have to deal in current cryptocurrencies or digital currencies, you know, ruled by the government as the only ones you can do, because they're going to be regulated and overseen by institutions that they support, and that they'll make something outside of that illegal, and you'll have to operate in the black market with that. I understand it's great to drive down the cost of transferring money. I mean, we have to deal with bank wires too, and we think they're ridiculously expensive for what they are. And it would be great to you know, take typical bank wire costs of, you know, for $20-$25 domestically, right? We know, and you know, 40 plus internationally, and make that for the few pennies it should be, because it's really just an electronic transfer, and that would be great. And, you know, they may adopt the platform and the protocols for doing that with a digital currency. The one thing we will give up, there's a lot of things also about digital currency where it always that has negatives about tracking what you do and such. So, you know, I think that, you know, even though there may be some things that are very attractive about digital currency, but going to a world where everything just becomes digitized, that from our what's called our libertarian streak, I have a lot of reservations about being happy about that.
You know, in the industrialized nations, we have so many competing alternatives to, you know, the crypto type of arrangement, more traditional means for financing and transfer of wealth. Outside the U.S., you know, obviously, where we see things like suddenly, I don't know, in India, you know, Prime Minister Modi just gets a wild hair and says, you know, I think I might just remove all paper currency from the market today. Good luck. In a nation where 80% of people regularly transact in paper and coin currency compared to the United States, which might be 30-40%. So these type of activities happen. Venezuela, another glaring example. Anybody who had access to cryptos is in a better position today in a currency that's been deflated by over 1,000,000% within a 12 to 24 month period. Chris Blasi, any parting comments for our listeners?
Back to the metals. I'm sure both a lot of investors are a bit frustrated, right? Expecting with very sound fundamentals that, you know, the metals should be higher than they are at this point. And this year has been somewhat disappointing. 2016 and 17 were obviously good years. I don't think a lot of people realize that they were pretty solid, good, solid years. I'm talking more people who are sitting outside the metals and haven't taken a position yet. We believe that this fall you're going to see the stability and the resumption of its of the rise up, and that's for a host of reasons. Hope they all just feel comfortable and hold tight, and you know that they have a great fall with their precious metals positions. And you know, if they ever have any questions about what we do and the power of diversification across the four metals, because there is a they are not the same and they do not move in lockstep, we'd be happy to discuss, you know, the advantage to being properly diversified within the precious metal space.
Would you like to tell people more about what they can find at Neptune Global?
A great way to learn about us is to visit our website, neptuneglobal.com. You know, you can learn about the PMC ounce. You could do, we have a tool called the PMC calculator, which you access from the homepage. It lets you do a simulated trade. It's all in real time, but the power of it is you see what the diversification is, what metals you own and what quantities, and it shows you what percentage of your investment is going into each of those metals. So it really helps a person to visualize the logic and the power of the product. Of course, you know, we have contact, our phone number and such on the site. We love to answer questions for people. We also like to share that the PMC ounce is now being sold by other dealers. It's getting so much traction and such wide adoption that it is actually available for other dealers now. And for anyone who thinks it's new and they're concerned, the PMC ounce has actually been around since 2008. So it's got a 10-year track record, and it received a patent in 2013. So, you know, it's a physical precious metals whole offering, so it's got all the benefits and of physical precious metals, but trades in real time as if you're trading an ETF, the real thing. It's been doing tremendously well, and it's doing what it's designed to do, which is it's not about beating the market, because it's not an actively traded fund and it's not a fund at all, but it's a diversified physical precious metals position that mitigates some of the extreme volatility that you experience if you're in just one or two of the metals, because of the blended return of the metals and the weighting of the holding that, you know, you're capturing the blended return with managing that risk. And that's the risk of higher volatility.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how the markets play out, in particular the precious metals and the cryptos, over the next, 6 months. So we'll look forward to hearing more comments from you at Neptune Global.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd like to say the adherence to the metals and such, they deserve it. They've waited a long time, and I really appreciate getting on the show and a chance to share these ideas with you, Chris. Wish all your listeners, great fall. Hope their investments work out well for them. Take care now.
This is Robert E. GoldSeek.com Radio. There are times when my commentaries inevitably delve into the political landscape, namely because so many of the critical issues that impact our lives are inextricably linked to politics. The topic of digital censorship is one that I have been addressing periodically since the 2016 presidential election and more frequently in recent months, primarily because your freedom of speech underpins and supports all your other freedoms in the U.S. When that freedom is eroded in any manner, the stage is set for all your other freedoms to be constricted at an accelerated pace. I am an absolute supporter, without compromise, of your freedom of speech. Dangerous precedents are being experimented with from the likes of Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Apple, and the remainder of the big players. Which is why I must say I am extremely pleased with President Trump's August 24th tweet on this very subject, which states, "Social media giants are silencing millions of people. Can't do this, even if it means we must continue to hear fake news like CNN, whose ratings have suffered gravely. People have to figure out what is real and what is not, without censorship." I couldn't agree more. Censorship is the line in the sand that separates freedom from bondage. Censorship is an assault on your mind that, if accepted, rapidly leads to its own form of mental bondage and self-censorship, which in turn facilitates and escalates varying degrees of physical, financial, and societal bondage. You can look at it from any angle, and it's still a downward slope to a subterranean mausoleum where freedom goes to die. I don't know about you, but my freedom, that our forefathers and veterans fought and suffered and died for, isn't negotiable. Your freedom, especially your freedom to speak, shouldn't be negotiable either. Not to anyone or any party, for any reason whatsoever. The tweet released August 24th by President Trump will be a defining message going forward, because people really do have to figure out what is real and what is not, without censorship. It's a sad day when control over how the swamp is managed and purged descends into totalitarian censorship efforts. You have a mind, you have common sense. Use them both. Because if you fail to stand up for freedom of speech right now, you are limiting yourself, your children, and future generations from what they will be willing and able to stand up for going forward. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ComfortChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Oh. Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.